Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Audrey Dean Kelly? Did y'all like Audrey? Audrey's self-titled CD can be found on iTunes, and more can be found out about Audrey at Reverb Nation and Facebook. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton with his JFK paintings here, his portraits. And this one over here is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight is our second JFK show and coincides with JFK 50 Years Later, a photography exhibit showing at 8 venues throughout the Argenta Arts District that features rarely and never before seen images from the largest JFK archive in the world. Tonight's stories center around the personal way the writers will always be connected to JFK. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Deborah Carroll's schoolgirl crush is unwillingly tied to that fateful day. Then Sandra Hamilton's wounds link her to two historical dates. And we'll end the night with Tim Bennett, an image on TV, and a touching connection. But let's start the night with Mary Beck as her sighting of the man who would become president bonds to an unlikely event in Family Ties.
It was a cool September day in 1959 when my brother Don, my mom, baby sister Becky, Uncle Jim, and I piled into our 1950 Chevy and headed to Utah State Fair. I was 9 years old, Mom was driving, and we all talked about the cotton candy, hot dogs, and seeing a bearded lady and tattooed man, and other sights of interest of those times. It was a once-a-year outing. Little did we know, we could have found bearded ladies and tattooed men every day in Southern California, but I digress. There was an air of excitement, and the fair was always crowded, but as we got closer and closer, we were surprised to see cars stacked up, double parked for miles. Mom just kept on going, not pulling over like all the other cars. We were making good time. Then a policeman ahead of us stopped her car and insisted Mom pull to the curb. Suddenly, sirens blared from behind and an escort of police cars and security chaperones roared down the street. It was loud. That was when I first heard the name of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Everyone with any Irish blood thought he was their rich cousin. In my family, coming from O'Connors, weren't any different. At that time, Kennedy was running in a primary to become the nominee of his party. I didn't know all that, being just 9 years old, but my mother did, and she liked this Kennedy, filled with wit, charm, good looks, and his gorgeous, glamorous wife, Jackie. "Look, Mom," shouted, "there he is." Although obviously half of us were on one side of the car and half of us were on the other side, we all managed to smush over for a look at the handsome candidate. I saw a silhouette of a man, this Kennedy, going by. I'm not sure how much of a look I really got of him. The car went by pretty fast. I know this much, it was surely 1959 because Jackie was not with him. If Jackie had been there, my mother might have just been content to turn around and go back home, not bothering with the fair. For she was that kind of person, Jackie. When people saw her, they were content with that. But we just had Jack. And unfortunately, our car, 9 years old like me, was not as energetic as I was. Once stopped, the Chevy just wanted to take a break. For all the priming and cranking, the old gray mare just would not get up and go. My mom took her fun seriously, however, and she was determined that we were all going to have a great time. We got a tow truck to haul us to the fairgrounds, put baby Becky in her stroller, and stuffed our hungry faces with as much junk as we could find, and at a fair, that is a lot. It was in the days when girls all wore dresses all the time, basically. Did not matter if you're going to hang upside down like a monkey, you just had to figure out how to cover your panties. That made it very exasperating that early evening when every time I happened to walk over a ground grate, a burst of air would shoot up. Might have looked cool when Marilyn did it, but I tell you, it's no picnic when you're desperately looking for a restroom to have all that breezy stuff going on. Still, I was having fun, sort of, for me. The food and the rides were terrific. I like rides, and seldom, if ever, get car sick or anything like that. We were all chock full when my brother asked me to go with him on a parachute ride. It looked and sounded wonderful, and it was. Up in the air so high, the entire fairground spread out in bright stripes and triangles. We went spinning around, and on the way down, it was, well, what I imagine a parachute jump would be like. And all the excitement of seeing JFK, car failures, gooey food, and strange hairy beans, I'd forgotten something about my brother. This kid could not go three spins on a playground ride without upchucking. And yes, he did. Below us on a spiral stream, spun out in the target zone, and suddenly I'd had about as much fun as I could stand for a day. I'm sure other things happened. I don't remember anything else of note, but maybe that was enough for one day. For anyone anywhere, I had a glimpse into the future at the man who would stare down the Russians during the days we were all under our school desk. For all that, there's no way I can ever separate the experience of seeing the wonderful Mr. Kennedy, our rich cousin, from that of my brother on the parachute ride. Things just happen that way in families.
Born Mary Louise Laprise, Mary Beck says that says a lot about her. An artist in oils and ink and writer of many formats, her favorite genre is humorous shorts as long as they are laundered. In our next story, Deborah Carroll's connection to that fateful day is forever tied to another man's handsome face in Innocence Lost.
It was the fall of 1963, and one of the best parts of the seventh grade was Mr. Gunther, our science teacher. He looked just like Paladin, who was on Half Gun Will Travel. I always stared at him, wondering how he shaved that little dimple in his chin. Up until that point, all my teachers in elementary school had been women, mostly older women. So having a handsome man as my teacher was going to be really cool. I don't think I could have learned anything in that class because I saw his mouth moving, but I never heard the words. It didn't matter. I could stare at him for hours. And then came the morning of Friday, November 22nd. Things had really changed that year since starting junior high. The first thing I did was cut my waist-length hair so it went better with my Beatles look with a red blazer and a black skinny tie. Never thought girls would want to dress like this, but it seems to work for those special occasions. We were finally getting used to riding a bus. We decided that walking several miles to Nichols' store to meet in the morning to catch the bus made a whole lot more sense than catching it at the end of the street. My favorite thing that year was Dr. Pepper with some cashews dropped in it and a moon pie. Some girl said it was supposed to make you feel sexy, but it never worked for me. I thought it would be cool to have my Uncle Jimmy being a coach at Southwest Junior High, but he didn't cut me any slack. All the kids were afraid of him because he walked around the school grounds with that paddle, hitting it on his right thigh because he knew he could use it. He broke up the last cat fight before the gym class. A couple of the girlhoods got in a fight in the hall over a guy, and I was rooting for Nora to win. She was cool for a hood. She kept getting in trouble for smoking behind the school. We were in gym class together, and I got to be friends with her so she could protect me when things got scary. Maybe our friendship was one-sided. I just thought she was my friend because she was older and in the ninth grade. I think maybe she got held back a couple of years. A group of us had been friends since the first grade, and now we got to ride the bus together all the way from Meadowcliff to Broadmoor. Ours was one of the first houses in the neighborhood. One day, Mom and Dad were clearing rocks out of the backyard. We had a creek that separated our property from the school property, and Daddy was chunking rocks over the new fence with the little cocker spaniels on the gate. He hit a wasp nest. Mom ran into the house, but Daddy kept running around and around the house because the wasps were chasing him. My two sisters and I were home, and we were laughing too hard to realize to be afraid for him. He finally was able to make it in the house, but he was stung pretty bad. So there I was on that Friday morning, elbows on my desk, hands on my chin, the smile on my face, staring at handsome Mr. Gunther as he sat on the edge of the desk talking to us. Then a voice came over the school intercom. It always announced things, and we usually didn't listen because it was just so stupid. But for some reason that day, the principal sounded different. Something was wrong. The president. Somebody has shot President Kennedy today in the parade in Dallas. My love-struck smile changed to shock. What? What did they say? Oh, no. What? Mr. Gunther stood up and he turned and he looked at the intercom over the blackboard. My heart sank as I watched the shock and pain and doubt and disbelief roll across his face like a storm. I felt my hand cover my mouth as Mr. Gunther's dimple just seemed to disappear. The president has been shot? I could hear people crying. And the loud beat of my heart throbbing in my ears, I just couldn't get beyond the shock. That handsome President Kennedy that all of us girls had a crush on. Shot? The first real politician other than Governor Faubus that I was aware of. Shot? How can that happen? On Friday, November 22nd, 1963, in my seventh grade science class, Southwest Junior High in Little Rock, Arkansas, with Mr. Gunther, my life and the way I looked at the world changed. It will be forever forged in my memory, watching Jackie Kennedy, a 34-year-old widow, climb out of the airplane, the flag-draped casket, and a little boy saluting in the parade. All the memories permeate my soul like the smell of popcorn makes me think of walking into a downtown theater. A time of innocence was gone with the flash of a rifle shot. The memories, always there, always there.
Deborah Carroll proudly claims Hot Springs, Little Rock, and North Little Rock as her hometowns. Although she's an award-winning author, artist, and sculptor, she dearly loves being a grandmother. Next, Sandra Hamilton's physical and emotional scars tie her to two different dates in Walking to Camelot.
The excitement grew as my high school's marching band played and the presidential helicopter touched down at the fairgrounds in Little Rock, Arkansas. In those innocent days of 1963, we were allowed to get amazingly close to the charismatic president, separated only by a chain-link fence. In just two short months, all of that would be forever changed. That day, afternoon classes were suspended. John F. Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, was coming to visit our town. The majority of the student body walked to the fairgrounds to witness the brief stop that President Kennedy would make on a trip to dedicate a new dam system. Wanting to look my best, I wore my newest outfit and brand new leather shoes with no socks. The 1 mile walk soon had rubbed huge blisters on both of my feet. The school year at Little Rock Central High had barely begun on that September day. This was the same campus where President Eisenhower, just 6 years earlier, had sent in federal troops to force Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus to allow integration and to protect the 9 brave African-American students as they simply attended the all-white school. Racial tensions were still high in Little Rock, but the young, handsome 35th President of the United States was at the forefront of the Civil Rights Movement, and for many of us, he was our hero. For others, change had come with resentment, but this was simply a rare opportunity to see the president. He was the first politician who didn't seem old to us and the first to address the youth in a way that made us feel valued and full of promise. His youthfulness made the 3 years that separated him from my dad seem like a whole generation. I stood there that day in the crowd of teenagers, my feet aching as I listened, spellbound, to the president's speech. Truth be told, I didn't really take in what he had to say. I was so giddy with the excitement of seeing this man in person that I could scarcely focus on his message. The glow of that special visit was still with me on November 22, 1963. The halls were filled with students banging locker doors and hurrying to class after lunch. As we neared classroom doors, teachers stood with somber faces, quietly sharing the news. The president has been shot. Come in and sit down. Surely, I thought, it must be just a wound in his arm or something, just a nick. He will recover. I noticed a handsome upperclassman that I had a crush on skipping down the hall in celebration of this horrific news, apparently in resentment of the president's commitment to racial harmony. Instantly, I felt nothing but repulsion for this once appealing young man. Mrs. Ryman hurried us into the geometry class, where we sat in stunned silence. Soon the announcement came over the static-laced intercom. Students, the President of the United States has died. Please rise for a moment of silence. I stood with wobbly knees in disbelief and looked out the window to the front lawn to watch as the U.S. flag was lowered to half-staff. We were later dismissed to the auditorium to watch the scant coverage of the confused aftermath on a television with rabbit ears. Thankfully, this awful event took place on a Friday so that we could be with our families for the weekend to absorb all that had happened. Church services were immediately scheduled throughout Little Rock. My sister came home from college, and we all attended a special service at our church. Bells tolled all over town. A few days later, we watched on TV as the world paid last respects to the president. Our hearts broke when the little boy saluted his father's coffin as it was carried down the street on the horse-drawn caisson. It was his third birthday. The little red scars rubbed by my brand new shoes on the walk to see President Kennedy on that autumn day would remain on my feet for decades. Often, I touched them, remembering all of the wounds.
San Spots Hamilton is a native of Little Rock who graduated from the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville with a degree in art education and a minor in English. She currently works as a designer and writer and still seeks Camelot. In our final story of the night, an image is seared into Tim Bennett's memory, and along with it, a connection in Father and Son.
I was only a child on November 22, 1963. What little I do recall was filtered through the mind of a five-year-old, where the letter K, as in JFK, would more likely stand for kindergarten than a politician's name. For me, it was finger paints, learning shapes and songs and playing games, toasted cheese sandwiches and Campbell's tomato soup, penny candy, playing outside, cartoons, and being excited when Dad came home. My dad was tall and thin back then, clad in shiny black dress shoes, black socks, woolen blend slacks with a thin leather belt, and a starched white shirt with a sharp skinny tie. He would come home each workday evening to a mini celebration of his arrival. If I greeted him first, it was me running to him, saying his parental honorific over and over again. And if he found me, he would greet me with dentine gum, a little compact oblong stick of cinnamon goodness. Dad was good at greetings and farewells. When he would put my brother and me to bed, we would beg him to carry us like he showed us how a fireman would. A variation on that was being carried like a sack of potatoes. We would giggle and laugh while he carried us all the way to the bunk beds in the front bedroom that we shared. "Sleep tight and don't let the bed bugs bite," he would say after depositing us on the beds. Dad had a pipe, glasses, and a spy novel, more often than not, on the end table by his easy chair in the den. He was not a morning person and was not to be trifled with before coffee. He really wasn't ever to be trifled with, and the foolishness of childhood sometimes clearly annoyed him. But he was there like the sun rose every morning, and Mom was his favorite person. There was security in knowing that. Years later, not much else seemed to be secure after that somewhat innocent time seemed to suddenly change that year. I remember school after the president's death. Our teacher, Mrs. Thompson, earnestly asked the group of boys and girls which of our mothers had cried that morning. All the kids raised their hands except me. "Timothy, didn't your mother cry this morning?" asked the teacher, somewhat surprised. She most likely had been seeking affirmation from the community via its children for her own grief, rather than any literal answer. "No," I answered truthfully. I hadn't seen my mother cry that morning. After class was out, I walked a few blocks down the sidewalk from our elementary school to our suburban home. I mentioned it to my mother. "Of course I cried this morning," my mother informed me. "You just didn't see me." In a household where anger and frustration were practically celebrated with various verbal permutations and voice levels going from irritation to ire, grief was different. It was often private, unshared. Years later, I realized my mother was also worried that the teacher would think that we were Goldwater Republicans. As my childhood continued, I experienced how America would work through her grief regarding the loss of her beloved president. I remember the shiny 50-cent pieces that came out with his face on them. I learned that some Mexican merchants loved to receive them in payment when tourists went shopping over the border in Tijuana. I saw a framed portrait of the man in someone's living room where Spanish was spoken. America's first Catholic president struck a chord with many different groups of people, but those who were in the faith seemed particularly devoted. Later, that portrait would be joined by those of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy in some homes. It was a strange time in which to be reared in America. Why did our leaders keep getting killed? More than one child must have asked. A few days later, after that particular kindergarten class, when I had noted my first view of our school flag at half-mast, I sat down with my dad and the rest of the family in front of our small black and white television. As I watched the somber funeral scene play out, our teenage neighbor and babysitter pointed out the president's son, John F. Kennedy Jr. "Look, there's John John," Carrie said, referring to him by his nickname. "He's your age." I saw the somber little boy in the dark, long, stiff coat with his mother at the caisson. I couldn't grasp the enormity of shock and sorrow that Americans were feeling at that time. But I did understand one thing then. A little boy had lost his daddy. Years later, I would learn that John John was 3 at the time, not 5. But it didn't matter. The image and the connection were seared into my memory. 30 years later, I would stand beside my father's casket in a private visit to the funeral home before the graveside ceremony. I would thank God for giving him to us and using him in my life, and I would give him back to God. And that's all that a son or a nation can do.
Tim Bennett has written for local and national publications. He teaches Spanish to high school students and writes poetry as well as creative nonfiction. He and his wife, Marla, live in Batesville, Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
This song's called The Roosevelt Hotel. I wrote it about a couple years ago when I was in college. I used to go out to this place in Los Angeles and have some crazy nights, and this is about one of those crazy nights.
Driving in a Mercedes, looking like an old lady. Lipstick lasts for days and months. Everything she wears is flashy. People call her nouveau trash. Wish that I could tell her just once. Tries to look like a social, I reckon. Wears the worst of every collection.